So next we'll have Barnabas Babana telling us about chemical stratification of type 1AX supernovae.
Wow, yes. Okay, thank you very much and welcome everyone. I'm gonna tell you the story how we tried to somehow constrain the chemical abundances of these peculiar thermonuclear type of explosions via the technique called abundance tomography technique. As you might know, as the supernova ejecta expands with time, the photosphere draws back and we get inside deeper and deeper into the ejecta. Which means if we analyze, and when I say analyze, I mean if we fit not only one spectrum, but a whole spectral time series of the same object, it's a self-consistent motor ejecta, then we are able to map the physical and the chemical properties of the whole ejecta. All we need is just a reliable and a quick spectral synthesis code, which was, in our case, the TARDIS, which is a one-dimensional radiative transfer code. So basically, what we did is we defined a one-dimensional structure, and in every radial cell, we had to define the density values and the mass fraction of each chemical element and a few more physical properties. As you can see, here the troubles have just started because simply this means too many fitting parameters. You cannot handle so many fitting parameters, not even with a good strategy or with a fast synthesis code, except if you have also a lot of fitting constraints, fitting limitations. Unfortunately, first we were interested in normal supernova 1A, of course, but unfortunately, the spectral lines for normal 1A are simply too wide and overlap each other, which means that this causes a significant degeneracy between the fitting parameters. We had to look for objects which has something in common with the normal 1As, but at the same time could offer us more fitting constraints. And these objects were the type 1AX supernovae, which also originates from the thermonuclear explosion of white dwarf, but at the same time, they are pretty faint. And they are not just faint, but they are faint on a very wide scale. So here you can see their peak absolute magnitude varies over a range of four magnitudes, which is super extreme. They also evolve pretty fast, but they do not follow the so-called Phillips relations, so we cannot use them as distant indicators, or at least not this way. Looking at their spectra, seemingly nearly the same spectral features appear in their optical regime as in the normal 1As, but if we compare them directly, it's getting pretty obvious that these spectral features are less blue shifted. And again, these subclass of thermonuclear explosions show a very high diversity. Their photospheric velocity at the moment of maximum light varies from 2,000 up to almost 9,000 kilometers per second. But that's not everything. What is more important for us that the spectral enhancers are also more narrow, which means fewer overlapping and more fitting constraints for us. And yeah, that's good. That's what we were looking for. Moreover, we had some clues and ideas based on the literature what kind of explosion mechanism could cause this extreme diversity of type 1AX supernovae. This is the pure deflagration. Such explosion mechanism has already been the subject of hydrodynamical simulation, for instance, in the Fink paper from 2014, where the authors used different number of initial ignition spots in order to scale the strength of the deflagration. Well, right now, only these five models are important for us, from N1 to N20, because these models almost perfectly reproduces the very diverse physical properties of the subclass. However, none of these five models are energetic enough to fully unbound a Chandrasekhar mass white dwarf. Instead, they leave behind a so-called bone remnant, which means that their ejecta mass is significantly less than the Chandrasekhar mass. This will be very important at the end of our story, so keep this in our mind. This deflagration scenario also set some pretty strict constraints about its escaping ejecta structure. First, this is very strongly mixed, meaning that basically every chemical element has a constant mass fraction through the ejecta. And this ejecta contains significant amount of unburnt material, which is good, again, because these two aspects are very easy to test in our abundance tomography analysis. And basically, that's what we did. But first, we had to put together a 1AX sample in order to fulfill the conditions of this abundance tomography technique. As I said, this technique requires more than one spectral epoch. We needed at least three, but obviously the more is better. And these, all of the spectra had to be obtained in the first few weeks after the explosions, because this has some serious limitation. It uses the photospheric approximation and is approximation only robust in case of normal 1As within the first few weeks, within the, let's say, the first 5 weeks after the explosion. So it seems logical that we keep this time range even for 1AX objects. We also needed reliable distance and reddening information. So in the end, it's no wonder that only 5 objects remained in our pocket, which is not too many. But lucky for us, these 5 1AX supernovae very nicely sample the upper half, or let's say the more luminous half of the whole 1AX population. So what we did basically, we fitted these 5 spectral time series individually, and we used the corresponding, the predictions of the corresponding deflagration models as initial starting values. And we changed only these values when the goodness of the fits required it. And, well, we changed them a lot, because this was necessary to reach this goodness of fit. This is the 11AY, one of the brightest type 1AX supernovae. And you cannot see yet, but here you can see how beautiful are these fits. Well, probably I'm not the right person to judge the goodness of the fits, but trust me, these are pretty good. The precise line identification, what you can see here, was just basically the bonus, because we were more interested in the best fit abundance profiles. Here you can see with solid lines, or best fit TARDIS models, compared to the dashed lines, the predictions of the deflagration model. And here's some contradiction. First, these best fit models are anything but not constant, especially not in the outermost regimes, where both the iron group elements and the intermediate mass elements show a relatively steep cutoff. But that's just one thing. The other thing, that looking in the innermost regions, there is basically no significant amount of carbon allowed in our best fit models. So these are pretty clear contradictions to the predictions of the deflagration models. But as I said earlier, in case of a such diverse subclass like the type 1AX supernovae, we cannot make general conclusions based only on one object. So we did the same analysis on the whole spectral sample, and we found that these abundance features I just mentioned exist in all the 5 individual models, but at different velocities. This gave us the idea whether we could construct a so-called abundance template for this sample. First step, we chose a reference velocity, which was basically the location, the velocity where the mass fraction of oxygen, with blue line, exceed the mass fraction of nickel. And we shifted this abundance profile according to this reference velocity to each other. Then we averaged the mass fractions in every velocity layer relative to the reference velocity, and we got this one, this averaged abundance template. So this seems nice, but also when we adopted this template to the exact epochs and for the, all the 5 supernovae in our sample, we got almost the same goodness of fit as for the best fit models, meaning that basically we were able to describe the whole ejecta structure only with one fitting parameters, which would be pretty nice if we are right. It is also strengthens the idea that all these Typhon X supernovae share a common origin. And of course, it would make our life easier in the future when we want to extend our abundance tomography analysis in a greater sample. So much about the abundances. Let's look on the physical properties. So remember, these objects show a very diverse nature, both at the luminosity and the velocity. So is there any correlation between these two parameters? Well, if you look into the literature, you would say not really. Or if it's there any correlation, that must be pretty loose. Here you can see the peak absolute magnitude in the, as a function of the photospheric velocity. So this is a very loose correlation with a few outliers. But the good news is that our sample strengthens this correlation. As you can see here, the more luminous supernovae showed a significantly higher photospheric velocity. About these outliers, we started to make this abundance tomography technique on this 14CK, one of the outliers. And well, these analyses haven't been finished yet, but I can show you a few preliminary results. As you can see here, the fits are promising enough. And what we got, that the estimated photospheric velocity is approximately 1,500 kilometers higher than it was reported previously in the literature, which would mean that the 14CK is not an outlier at all. Of course, there is another one, but we really hope that in the near future we can use Typhon X supernovae as distant indicators. But first, there is a lot to do. We have to fulfill this gap at the fainter part, fainter region of the subclass, and this requires a lot of observation, especially with larger telescopes, taking into account that these are extremely faint objects. So in the last 2 minutes in my presentation, I would like to highlight another aspect of peculiarity of Typhon X supernovae related to their late time evolution. So the fact is that these kind of objects never really enter into a nebulous phase, not even several hundred days after the explosion. Instead, they show both four-bit dynamational lines and permitted phase signal profiles. So here are three examples for late time 1AX spectra. And this is a thin plus fit where this is not noise, but a lot of weak but permitted ion lines. And these permitted feed signal profiles always require a source of continuum, a source of an extra photosphere after 300 days of the explosion. So what could be the source of this extra photosphere? Well, we have some idea. Remember that the deflagration scenario possibly leaves behind the bone remnant, and this bone remnant can be a source of super Eddington wind, which could cause this extra photospheric component. This is also supported by our modeling approach that we try to extend our analysis over this 5-week limitation for 11AY. And as you can see here, we found almost perfect matches even around 90 days after the explosions, which is surprising because it would not work for a normal 1A. There must something happening here. And something interesting should happen between 90 and 190 days, but unfortunately, we're not able to characterize it because we lack of these epochs, because of obvious reason, basically because of the sun. And it's not true only for 11AY, but basically every supernova in 1X. It's not impossible to get these missing epochs, but we need to get really lucky, and we need some giant telescope to observe these very faint objects. So we already submitted a few proposals, and yeah, fingers crossed. Thank you for your attention.
Questions?
Yeah, like your proposal to use 1AX as distance indicators, because the velocity is essentially independent of dust and other things that screw up other distance indicators. But what kind of precision do you think you can obtain with this?
Well, since this is just a distant idea, I cannot say exact numbers, but but based on the TARDIS fittings, we could estimate the photospheric velocity with uncertainty of 200, 300 kilometers per second. So I don't know, honestly, whether it is competitive with other kind of distance indicators, but I guess every other objects, every extra objects which could give us some clues about the distances could be just could have just benefits from this. So unfortunately, we don't know it yet.
Any more questions? If not, then thanks. Okay.
Yeah, I'll just ask another one. So if my understanding is correct, you've shown through your tomography that actually the TARDIS tomography profile is a lot more smooth and you had the carbon problem. So basically you're saying the Finck models or these pure deflagration models, they're actually not reproducing the abundance profile that you're observing. But then in the end you're saying, well, this is still a good model because it explains, the remnant explains the late time extra luminosity. So can you comment on that? So do you rule them out now or do you still favor them?
Okay, that's a good question because, I mentioned two contradictions. First, the octermos layers, which it's under debate how much can we trust in our results in the octermos layers, because it strongly depends on the choice of the density profile. But at the same time, the other contradiction, the lack of carbon, seems pretty serious, and well, we don't know yet how could it is explained, to be explained. Maybe we need some correction for the deflagration models. Maybe TARDIS handled this iron. So we possibly need some NLT correction for the carbon lines. But so far, this limitation seems pretty straight. Right now, the deflagration models, or some kind of modification of the deflagration models, is our best guess because of the possible existing bone remnant.
There's also a couple of recent papers by Sam Jones, very similar setup except for an oxygen-neon white dwarfs triggered by electron capture that ignites the oxygen burning. And of course, there you wouldn't have the carbon problem. So maybe that's something.
Okay, I will check it. Thank you.
Okay, let's thank the speaker again. So that marks the end of the session 2.